Our next guest is Trish Hall. Why should you take advice from her? Well, for 5 years, she set the high standard for which opinion pieces ultimately landed on the New York Times op-ed page. Her new book is Writing to Persuade, and in it, she shares that wisdom. She lays it out in terms easy to emulate. Every week, Hall and her staff waded through 1,000 or so unsolicited opinion pieces, the majority of them too wordy, too vague, too jargony, or just plain dull. What stood out in the pack? That element of surprise or a new idea, clarity of language, respect for the reader. Again, Trish Hall is former editor of the New York Times op-ed page, and the new book is Writing to Persuade. It's a great pleasure to welcome Trish Hall to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. What gave you the idea, and I guess another way of asking this is how long this idea has been with you, of writing a book, of teaching people how to persuade?
Well, it's funny because I hadn't thought of it at all, or I would have taken notes when I was the op-ed editor, but I said I had a job in the newsroom as sort of the bridge between the newsroom and the business side, trying to come up with projects that would be journalistically sound and also profitable. And I was talking to someone who wrote for me an op-ed, Arthur Brooks, who was the head of the AEI. And he said, why don't you write a book about op-ed? People are fascinated by how it works. So I really owe it to Arthur. And it was a fascinating experience to really delve into the psychology of persuasion after having edited so many op-eds.
When it comes to realizing, I would think it's difficult to really analyze and put into words what it is that you do, right? I mean, that we tend to do it in a very natural fashion, and to think about it in very precise terms seems to me like it would be a challenge.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it, because I love editing, and I think I edit in many ways just instinctually, but I did have to think about what actually makes a piece work, what changes people's minds. And I looked back at a lot of pieces that I knew were popular with readers and pieces that have moved me. And what was interesting was that the psychology confirmed that there were reasons that those pieces worked. You reach people with emotion and with stories. You don't reach them with jargon or by berating them. So the research that's done by psychologists really confirmed for me, it explained for me really why the pieces that were popular were and what made them work.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts, how do you see ultimately this book being used? How would you like it to be employed?
I think there are a lot of different people who might find it useful. I could imagine high school students headed to college might find it helpful, just entering a world where they have to do a lot of writing. I think a lot of professors who were very important contributors to op-ed would find it useful because they are many times very smart people with something important to say, and they get kind of lost in the language of their field. And sometimes they have a hard time talking to a general audience. I was a business reporter and editor, and my first job at the Wall Street Journal, a lot of it involved untangling and translating business-centric language. So I think a lot of business people who want to be in what they call the conversation would find it useful because they, too, sometimes don't know how to speak to a general audience. So I think there's a lot of possible readers because we all write a lot today. We write our own emails and texts, and we're on Facebook, and some people are on Twitter. So even though it's a very visual world and sound and radio and podcasts, and there's many forms of media, everybody seems to be writing more. So I think it's important for people to think about the effect of their words.
You make it clear very early that writing short form is far harder than it looks and is a challenge to even the best of writers. So what do we do to immediately put us in a mindset to help us in writing in that short form?
I think one big mistake people make is they try to say too much and they try to cover a huge territory. And it's much more effective in the short form to really just focus on one thing. And I think sometimes you can tell whether what you're writing has worked. whether it's really effective by writing a headline for it. So if you're submitting it someplace, you won't get to write the headline. But if you try to write the headline and you can't say in a couple of words what it's really about and make it clear that it's about something that someone really needs to read and something they don't know, you probably haven't focused it enough.
The other thing that you talk about, which I think is so interesting, is that things that you would take for granted that you point out in the book, like or not take for granted, but you would think that maybe people wouldn't have to be reminded, and yet they obviously have to be reminded, like write what you know and don't make stuff up.
I know. It sounds a little obvious and silly when you say that, but it's in their daily life, I think a lot of people naturally exaggerate when they're telling stories, and that's fine. But when you're writing something that's going to be published, it's very helpful if it's true, because if it's not, you'll get caught out and you'll get mocked. And then the whole thing about writing what you know, I mean, there was a very industrious college student when I was at op-ed who would send me pieces all the time on everything, you know, how to deal with peace in the Middle East. And he was interested in everything, but he wasn't an expert in anything. So there was really no point of running his opinions on the op-ed page. So I think if people really look at what they know, and they don't have to be, you know, at a think tank or a professor, but what do they know and what have they experienced and what might be useful about that for other people to hear? And that's really what I mean by write what you know, what you have some authority and sort of an authentic relationship with.
You also talk about how good writing is good editing. How much is that on the shoulders of the writer? And how much, obviously, is that in your position up to you as an op-ed editor?
Well, I mean, I think every writer makes the mistake of sending pieces that are too long because they hope, well, maybe this time they'll just squish it in. I've done that myself plenty of times. But if you are submitting pieces to places that get a lot of material, you want to make life easy for those editors. So you want to submit it at the required length, and you want to edit yourself and look at it and look at it and look at it until it's as tight and as clear as it can be. Now, obviously, the editors will edit, but if you turn in something that's three times as long as what they can use, or you think someone else will do that work for you, you know, they probably won't unless, you know, you're the president of the United States or something like that.
You talk about the importance of emotion, of sharing stories that connect and that have us feel things. And do you find that that is something that is often discounted?
Yeah, I think people sometimes wanting to sound really serious don't want to put in anything personal or anything emotional. But we did find over time that the stories that resonated the most with people had some kind of personal aspect to them, even if they were about larger policy issues. You know, it might be a doctor writing from Syria about what it was like to try to treat people in the middle of a war. I'm not saying that people have to just reveal everything about themselves, but if there's something that makes it feel, that makes the reader feel something, I think it makes a big difference.
When you have that emotion and you do, and you are furious, how do you channel that in the proper way? How do you make that point?
I mean, fury and anger are obviously like useful and effective emotions. They don't always persuade people. I don't think you persuade people in person by yelling at them, but your rage can, you know, inspire you to write about something. You just can't be enraged at your reader. You have to.
But you can be enraged.
You have to sort of respect the reader.
But you can be enraged at a situation.
Yes, of course.
And so how does that not come off as being heavy-handed?
Well, if it's just rage, I'm not sure that it goes anywhere. I mean, you know, if you're enraged at, say, what's going on in different states in the country with abortion, and you just like are furious that these people are so stupid, you know, you're not really going to convince anybody. you're just going to be spouting off your rage. I think you have to use the rage to inspire you towards something effective, which might mean understanding why that's happening and giving some kind of counter-argument that is strong. I think it can't just be spouting. And I understand that there are a lot of people who do that, and they especially, you know, they might enjoy it, but I don't know that it's always persuasive.
As the former editor of the New York Times op-ed page, what were you longing for to see come in as submissions? What were you hoping that you would get more of?
Oh, that's an interesting question. We got so much of everything, but every once in a while, and we worked with regular writers and the columnists, so a lot of what I was working on, I was expecting, but every once in a while, something would just show up. It wasn't like somebody knew somebody or they had a PR person. An article would just show up in my email, and it would be amazing. Like, there's a guy named Sam Polk who now has a food business in Los Angeles helping poor people. But at the time, he was in finance, and he wrote about how he was addicted to money, and he thought it had hurt his life, and he dealt with it through therapy, and he changed the way he lived. You know, it was just interesting. Sometimes they were personal stories that had a larger social meaning because it is a time where people seem to judge themselves by how much money they make. So it's not that there was a particular story I was hoping to get, but whenever you would get something that was just a surprise and really well written and really interesting, you think, I am the luckiest person in the world. I get to sit here and open these emails and meet these writers.
My final question to you is one about persuasion. It seems that so many people tell us that we are so divided on so many issues and we are so polarized that persuading anyone on anything is damn near impossible. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that a lot of the apparent polarization is magnified by social media, it has a lot of wonderful aspects, but I think it makes it seem that people are more polarized than they are. And there have been surveys that have confirmed that. So I'm not sure it's as bad as it seems. But I really do think one of the elemental things is that people demonize the other side. And you can't assume that the person who disagrees with you is an idiot or has no reason to think that. And that's just dangerous. And it doesn't really get you anywhere. So I do worry that the only way we get out of that polarization is kind of a step-by-step incremental thing where people try not to do that. But I also think there's a structural thing going on where we probably have to figure out how social media can reduce the temperature of that.
The name of the book is Writing to Persuade, How to Bring People Over to Your Side. The book is published by Liveright. It is a great pleasure to have Trish Hall on the program this morning. Trish, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Writing to Persuade, How to Bring People Over to Your Side. The book is published by Liveright. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.